Chapter 4 Hides 1 They had to go fireless 3 nights instead of 1 or 2. The last was the longest, most wretched 12 hours of Susanna's life.
Is it worse than the night Eddie died? She asked herself at one point. Are you really saying this is worse than lying awake in one of those dormitory rooms, knowing that was how you'd be lying from then on? Worse than washing his face and hands and feet? Washing them for the ground?
Yes, this was worse. She hated knowing it, and would never admit it to anyone else, but the deep, endless cold of that last night was far worse. She came to dread every light breath of breeze from the snowlands to the east and south. It was both terrible and oddly humbling to realize how easily physical discomfort could take control, expanding like poison gas until it owned all the floor space, took over the entire playing field. Grief? Loss? What were those things when you could feel cold on the march, moving in from your fingers and toes, crawling up your motherfucking nose, and moving where? Toward the brain, do it please you? And toward the heart? In the grip of cold like that, grief and loss were nothing but words. No, not even that, only sounds. So much meaningless quack as you sat shuddering under the stars, waiting for a morning that would never come. What made it worse was knowing there were potential bonfires all around them, for they'd reached the live region Roland called the Undersnow. This was a series of long, grassy slopes, most of the grass now white and dead, and shallow valleys where there were isolated stands of trees and brooks now plugged with ice. Earlier, in daylight, Roland had pointed out several holes in the ice and told her they'd been made by deer. He pointed out several piles of scat as well. In daylight, such sign had been interesting, even hopeful. But in this endless ditch of night, listening to the steady low click of her chattering teeth, it meant nothing. Eddie meant nothing. Jake neither. The dark tower meant nothing, nor did the bonfire they'd had out the outskirts of Castletown. She could remember the look of it, but the feel of heat warming her skin until it brought an oil of sweat was utterly lost, like a person who has died for a moment or two and has briefly visited some shining afterlife. She could only say that it had been wonderful. Roland sat with his arms around her, sometimes voicing a dry, harsh cough. Susanna thought he might be getting sick, but this thought also had no power, only the cold. Once, shortly before dawn finally began to stain the sky in the east, this was, she saw orange lights swirl dancing far ahead, past the place where the snow began. She asked Roland if he had any idea what they were. She had no real interest, but hearing her voice reassured her that she wasn't dead. Not yet, at least.
I think they're Hobbs.
What are they? She now stuttered and stammered everything.
I don't know how to explain them to you, he said. And there's really no need. You'll see them in time. Right now, if you listen, you'll hear something closer and more interesting.
At first she heard only the sigh of the wind. Then it dropped, and her ears picked up the dry swish of the grass below as something walked through it. This was followed by a low, crunching sound. Susanna knew exactly what it was. A hoof, stamping through thin ice, opening the running water to the cold world above. She also knew that in 3 or 4 days' time, she might be wearing a coat made from the animal that was now drinking nearby, but this also had no meaning. Time was a useless concept when you were sitting awake in the dark and in constant pain. Had she thought she had been cold before? That was quite funny, wasn't it?
What about Mordred? She asked. Is he out there, do you think?
Yes.
And does he feel the cold, like we do?
I don't know.
I can't stand much more of this, Roland. I really can't.
You won't have to. It'll be dawn soon. And I expect we'll have a fire tomorrow, come dark.
He coughed into his fist, then put his arm back around her.
You'll feel better once we're up and in the doings. Meantime, at least we're together.
2. Mordred was as cold as they were every bit, and he had no one.
He was close enough to hear them, though. Not the actual words, but the sound of their voices. He shuddered uncontrollably and had lined his mouth with dead grass when he became afraid that Roland's sharp ears might pick up the sound of his chattering teeth. The railway man's jacket was no help. He had thrown it away when it had fallen into so many pieces that he could no longer hold it together. He'd worn the arms of it out of Castletown, but then they had fallen to pieces as well, starting at the elbows, and he'd cast them into the low grass beside the old road with a petulant curse. He was only able to go on wearing the boots because he'd been able to weave long grass into a rough twine. With it, he'd bound what remained of them to his feet. He'd considered changing back to his spider form, knowing that body would feel the cold less. But his entire short life had been plagued by the specter of starvation, and he supposed that part of him would always fear it, no matter how much food he had at hand. The gods knew there wasn't much now. 3 severed arms, 4 legs, 2 partially eaten, and a piece of a torso from the wicker basket, that was all. If he changed, the spider would gobble that little bit up by daylight. And while there was game out here, he heard the deer moving around just as clearly as his white daddy did. Mordred wasn't entirely confident of his ability to trap it or run it down. So he sat and shivered and listened to the sound of their voices until the voices ceased. Maybe they slept. He might have dozed a little himself. And the only thing that kept him from giving up and going back was his hatred of them. That they should have each other when he had no one. No one at all. "Mordred's a hungry," he thought miserably. "Mordred's a cold. And Mordred has no one. Mordred's alone." He slipped his wrist into his mouth, bit deep, and sucked the warmth that flowed out. In the blood, he tasted the last of Rando Thoughtful's life, but so little, so soon gone. And once it was, there was nothing but the useless, recycled taste of himself. In the dark, Mordred began to cry. 3. 4 hours after dawn, under a white sky that promised rain or sleet, perhaps both at the same time, Susanna Dean lay shivering behind a fallen log, looking down into one of the little valleys. "You'll hear Oi," the gunslinger had told her. "And you'll hear me, too. I'll do what I can, but I'll be driving them ahead of me, and you'll have the best shooting. Make every shot count." What made things worse was her creeping intuition that Mordred was very close now, and he might try to bushwhack her while her back was turned. She kept looking around, but they had picked a relatively clear spot, and the open grass behind her was empty each time save once, when she had seen a large brown rabbit lolloping along with its ears dragging the ground. At last, she heard Oi's high-pitched barking from the copse of trees on her left. A moment later, Roland began to yell, "Hia! Hia! Get on, brisk! Get on, brisk, I tell thee! Never tarry! Never tarry a single—" Then the sound of him coughing. She didn't like that cough. No, not at all. Now she could see movement in the trees, and for one of the few times since Roland had forced her to admit there was another person hiding inside of her, she called on Detta Walker. "I need you. If you want to be warm again, you settle my hands so I can shoot straight." And the ceaseless shivering of her body stopped. As the herd of deer burst out of the trees, not a small herd either, there had to be at least 18 of them, led by a buck with a magnificent rack, her hands also stopped their shaking. In the right one, she held Roland's revolver with the sandalwood grips. Here came Oi, bursting out of the woods behind the final straggler. This was a muty doe, running, and with eerie grace, on 4 legs of varying sizes, with a 5th waggling bonelessly from the middle of her belly like a teat. Last of all came Roland, not really running at all, not anymore, but rather staggering onward at a grim jog. She ignored him, tracking the buck with the gun as the big fellow ran across her field of fire. "This way," she whispered. "Break to your right, honey child. Let's see you do it. Kamala, come, come." and while there was no reason why he should have, the buck leading his little fleeing herd did indeed veer slightly in Susanna's direction. Now she was filled with the sort of coldness she welcomed. Her vision seemed to sharpen until she could see the muscles rippling under the buck's hide, the white crescent as his eye rolled, the old wound on the nearest doe's foreleg where the fur had never grown back. She had a moment to wish Eddie and Jake were lying on either side of her, feeling what she was feeling, seeing what she was seeing, and then that was gone too. "I do not kill with my gun. She who kills with her gun has forgotten the face of her father. I kill with my heart," she murmured, and began shooting. The first bullet took the lead buck in the head, and he crashed over on his left side. The others ran past him. A doe leaped over his body, and Susanna's second bullet took her at the height of her leap, so that she crashed down dead on the other side, one leg splayed and broken, all grace gone. She heard Roland fire three times, but didn't look to see how he'd done. She had her own business to attend to, and she attended to it well. Each of the last four bullets in the cylinder took down a deer, and only one was still moving when he fell. It didn't occur to her that this was an amazing piece of shooting, especially with a pistol. She was a gunslinger after all, and shooting was her business. Besides, the morning was windless. Half the herd now lay dead in the grassy valley below. All the remainder, save one, wheeled left and pelted away downslope toward the stream. A moment later they were lost in a screen of willows. The last one, a yearling buck, ran directly toward her. Susanna didn't bother trying to reload from the little pile of bullets lying beside her on a square of buckskin, but took one of the riser plates instead, her hand automatically finding the dull gripping place. "Riser!" she screamed and flung it. It flew across the dry grass, elevating slightly as it did, giving off that weird moaning sound. It struck the racing buck at mid-neck. Droplets of blood flew in a garland around its head, black against the white sky. A butcher's cleaver could not have done a neater job. For a moment the buck ran on, heedless and headless, blood jetting from the stump of its neck as its racing heart gave up its last half a dozen beats. Then it crashed to its splayed forelegs less than 10 yards in front of her hide, staining the dry yellow grass a bright red. The previous night's long misery was forgotten. The numbness had departed her hands and her feet. There was no grief in her now, no sense of loss, no fear. For the moment, Susanna was exactly the woman that Ka had made her. The mixed smell of gunpowder and blood from the downed buck was bitter. It was also the world's sweetest perfume. Standing up straight on her stumps, Susanna spread her arms. Roland's pistol clenched in her right hand and made a Y against the sky. Then she screamed. There were no words in it, nor could there have been. Our greatest moments of triumph are always inarticulate. 4. Roland had insisted that they eat a huge breakfast, and her protests that cold corned beef tasted like so much lumpy mush cut zero ice with him. By 2 that afternoon, according to his fancy-schmancy pocket watch, right around the time the steady cold rain fattened into an icy drizzle, in other words, she was glad. She had never done a harder day of physical labor, and the day wasn't finished. Roland was by her all the while, matching her in spite of his worsening cough. She had time, during their brief but crazily delicious noon meal of seared deer steaks, to consider how strange he was, how remarkable. After all this time and all these adventures, she had still not seen the bottom of him, not even close. She had seen him laughing and crying, killing and dancing. She'd seen him sleeping and on the squat behind a screen of bushes with his pants down and his ass hung over what he called the log of ease. She'd never slept with him as a woman does with a man, but she thought she'd seen him in every other circumstance. And no, still no bottom. "That cough's sounding more and more like pneumonia to me," Susanna remarked, not long after the rain had started. They were then in the part of the day's activities Roland called Avenkar, carrying the kill and preparing to make it into something else. "Never let it worry you," Roland said. "I have what I need here to cure it. say true? She asked doubtfully.
Ye are, and these which I never lost. He reached into his pocket and showed her a handful of aspirin tablets. She thought the expression on his face was one of real reverence, and why not? It might be that he owed his life to what he called Aston. Aston and Chieflet. They loaded their kill into the back of Hofat's luxury taxi and dragged it down to the stream. It took 3 trips in all. After they'd stacked the carcasses, Roland carefully placed the head of the yearling buck atop the pile, where it looked at them from its glazed eyes.
"What you want that for?"
Susanna asked, with a trace of detta in her voice. "We're going to need all the brains we can get," Roland said, and coughed dryly into his curled fist again. "It's a dirty way to do the job, but it's quick, and it works." 5. When they had their kill piled beside the icy stream, "At least we don't have the flies to worry about," Roland said. The gunslinger began gathering deadwood. Susanna looked forward to the fire, but her terrible need of the previous night had departed. She'd been working hard, and for the time being, at least, was warm enough to suit her. She tried to remember the depth of her despair, how the cold had crept into her bones, turning them to glass, and couldn't do it. Because the body had a way of forgetting the worst things, she supposed. And without the body's cooperation, all the brain had were memories like faded snapshots. Before beginning his wood-gathering chore, Roland inspected the bank of the icy stream and dug out a piece of rock. He handed it to her, and Susanna rubbed a thumb over its milky, water-smoothed surface.
"Quartz?"
she asked. But she didn't think it was, not quite. "I don't know that word, Susanna. We call it chert. It makes tools that are primitive but plenty useful. Axe heads, knives, skewers, scrapers. It's scrapers we'll want, also at least one hand hammer."
"I know what we're going to scrape, but what are we going to hammer?"
"I'll show you, but first, will you join me here for a moment?" Roland got down on his knees and took her cold hand in one of his. Together they faced the deer's head. "We thank you for what we are about to receive," Roland told the head, and Susanna shivered. It was exactly how her father began when he was giving the grace before a big meal, one where all the family was gathered.
"Our own family is broken," she thought, but did not say.
Done was done. The response she gave was the one she had been taught as a young girl.
"Father, we thank thee.
Guide our hands and guide our hearts as we take life from death," Roland said. Then he looked at her, eyebrows raised, asking without speaking a word if she had more to say. Susanna found that she did.
"Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from evil. Thou art the kingdom and the power and the glory, now and forever."
"That's a lovely prayer," he said.
"Yes," she agreed. "I didn't say it just right. It's been a long time, but it's still the best prayer. Now let's do our business while I can still feel my hands."
Roland gave her an amen. 6. Roland took the severed head of the yearling deer, the antler nubs made lifting it easy, set it in front of him, then swung the fist-sized chunk of rock against the skull. There was a muffled cracking sound that made Susanna's stomach cringe. Roland gripped the antlers and pulled, first left and then right. When Susanna saw the way the broken skull wiggled under the hide, her stomach did more than cringe. It did a slow loop-the-loop. Roland hit twice more, wielding the piece of chert with near-surgical precision. Then he used his knife to cut a circle in the head hide, which he pulled off like a cap. This revealed the cracked skull beneath. He worked the blade of his knife into the widest crack and used it as a lever.
When the deer's brain was exposed, he took it out, set it carefully aside, and looked at Susanna.
We'll want the brains of every deer we killed. And that's what we need a hammer for.
Oh, she said in a choked voice. Brains.
To make a tanning slurry. But there's more use for chert than that. Look.
He showed her how to bang two chunks together until one or both shattered, leaving large, nearly even pieces instead of jagged lumps. She knew that metamorphic rocks broke that way, but schists and such were generally too weak to make good tools. This stuff was strong.
When you get chunks that break thick enough to hold on one side but thin to an edge on the other, Roland said, lay them by. Those will be our scrapers. If we had more time, we could make handles, but we don't. Our hands will be plenty sore by bedtime.
How long do you think it'll take to get enough scrapers?
Not so long, Roland said. Chert breaks lucky, or so I used to hear.
While Roland dragged deadwood for a fire into a copse of mixed willows and alders by the edge of the frozen stream, Susanna inspected her way along the embankments, looking for chert. By the time she'd found a dozen large chunks, she had also located a granite boulder rising from the ground in a smooth, weather-worn curve. She thought it would make a fine anvil. The chert did indeed break lucky, and she had 30 potential scrapers by the time Roland was bringing back his third large load of firewood. He made a little pile of kindling, which Susanna shielded with her hands. By then, it was sleeting, and although they were working beneath a fairly dense clump of trees, she thought it wouldn't be long before both of them were soaked. When the fire was lit, Roland went a few steps away, once more fell on his knees, and folded his hands. "Praying again?" she asked, amused.
"What we learn in our childhood, as a way of sticking," he said.
He closed his eyes for a few moments, then brought his clasped hands to his mouth and kissed them. The only word she heard him say was, "Gan." Then he opened his eyes and lifted his hands, spreading them and making a pretty gesture that looked to her like birds flying away. When he spoke again, his voice was dry and matter-of-fact. "Mister taking care of business."
"That's very well, then," he said. "Let's go to work."
7. They made twine from grass, just as Mordred had done, and hung the first deer, the one already headless, by its back legs from the low branch of a willow. Roland used his knife to cut its belly open, then reached into the guts, rummaged, and removed two dripping red organs that she thought were kidneys. "These for fever and cough," he said, and bit into the first one as if it were an apple. Susanna made a gurking noise and turned away to consider the stream until he was finished. When he was, she turned back and watched him cut circles around the hanging legs close to where they joined the body. "Are you any better?" she asked him uneasily.
"I will be," he said. "Now help me take the hide off this fellow. We'll want the first one with the hair still on it. We need to make a bowl for our slurry. Now watch."
He worked his fingers into the place where the deer's hide still clung to the body by the thin layer of fat and muscle beneath, then pulled. The hide tore easily to a point halfway down the deer's midsection.
"Now do your side, Susanna."
Getting her fingers underneath was the only hard part. This time they pulled together, and when they had the hide all the way down to the dangling forelegs, it vaguely resembled a shirt. Roland used his knife to cut it off, then began to dig in the ground, a little way from the roaring fire, but still beneath the shelter of the trees. She helped him, relishing the way the sweat rolled down her face and body. When they had a shallow, bowl-shaped depression 2 feet across and 18 inches deep, Roland lined it with the hide. All that afternoon, they took turns skinning the 8 other deer they had killed. It was important to do it as quickly as possible, for when the underlying layer of fat and muscle dried up, the work would become slower and harder. The gunslinger kept the fire burning high and hot, every now and then leaving her to rake ashes out onto the ground. When they had cooled enough so they would not burn holes in their bowl liner, he pushed them into the hole they'd made. Susanna's back and arms were aching fiercely by 5 o'clock, but she kept at it. Roland's face, neck, and hands were comically smeared with ash. "You look like a fella in a minstrel show," she said at one point. "Rastus Coon."
"Who's that?"
"Nobody but the white folks, fool," she said. "Do you suppose Mordred's out there watching us work?" All day she'd kept an eye peeled for him.
"No," he said, pausing to rest.
He brushed his hair back from his forehead, leaving a fresh smear and now making her think of penitence on Ash Wednesday.
"I think he's gone off to make his own kill."
"Mordred's a hungry," she said. And then, "You can touch him a little, can't you? At least enough to know if he's here or if he's gone."
Roland considered this, then said simply, "I'm his father." 8.
By dark, they had a large heap of deerskins and a pile of skinned, headless carcasses that surely would have been black with flies in warmer weather. They ate another huge meal of sizzling venison steaks, utterly delicious, and Susanna spared another thought for Mordred, somewhere out in the dark, probably eating his own supper raw. He might have matches, but he wasn't stupid. If they saw another fire in all this darkness, they would rush down upon it, and him. Then bang, 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 goodbye, Spider Boy. She felt a surprising amount of sympathy for him, and told herself to beware of it. Certainly he would have felt none for either her or Roland, had the shoe been on the other foot. When they were done eating, Roland wiped his greasy fingers on his shirt and said,
"That tasted fine."
"You got that right.
Now let's get the brains out, then we'll sleep."
"One at a time?" Susanna asked.
"Yes. So far as I know, brains only come one to a customer."
For a moment, she was too surprised at hearing Eddie's phrase, "one to a customer," coming from Roland's mouth to realize he'd made a joke. Lame, yes, but a bona fide joke. Then she managed a token laugh. "Very funny, Roland. You know what I meant." Roland nodded.
"We'll sleep one at a time. And stand a watch, yes. I think that would be best."
Time and repetition had done its work. She'd now seen too many tumbling guts to feel squeamish about a few brains. They cracked heads, used Roland's knife, its edge now dull, to pry open skulls and removed the brains of their kill. These they put carefully aside, like a clutch of large gray eggs. By the time the last deer was debrained, Susanna's fingers were so sore and swollen she could hardly bend them.
"Lie over," Roland said. "Sleep. I'll take the first watch."
She didn't argue. Given her full belly and the heat of the fire, she knew sleep would come quickly. She also knew that when she woke up tomorrow, she was going to be so stiff that even sitting up would be difficult and painful. Now, though, she didn't care. A feeling of vast contentment filled her. Some of it was having eaten hot food, but by no means all. The greater part of her well-being stemmed from a day of hard work, no more or less than that. The sense that they were not just floating along, but doing for themselves. "Jesus," she thought, "I think I'm becoming a Republican in my old age." Something else occurred to her then. How quiet it was. No sounds, but the sough of the wind, the whispering sleet now starting to abate, and the crackle of the blessed fire. "Roland?" He looked at her from his place by the fire, eyebrows raised. "You've stopped coughing."
He smiled and nodded.
She took his smile down into sleep, but it was Eddie she dreamed of. 9. They stayed 3 days in the camp by the stream, and during that time Susanna learned more about making hide garments than she would ever have believed, and much more than she really wanted to know. By casting a mile or so in either direction along the stream, they found a couple of logs, one for each of them. While they looked, they used their makeshift pot to soak their hides in a dark soup of ash and water. They set their logs at an angle against the trunks of 2 willow trees, close so they could work side by side, and used chert scrapers to dehair the hides. This took one day. When it was done, they bailed out the pot, turned the hide liner over, and filled it up again, this time with a mixture of water and mashed brains. This cold-weather hiding was new to her. They put the hides in this slurry to soak overnight, and while Susanna began to make thread from strings of gristle and sinew, Roland resharpened his knife, then used it to whittle half a dozen bone needles. When he was done, all of his fingers were bleeding from dozens of shallow cuts. He coated them with wood ash soak and slept with them that way, his hands looking as if they were covered with large and clumsy gray-black gloves. When he washed them off in a stream the following day, Susanna was amazed to see the cuts already well on their way to healing. She tried dabbing some of the wood ash stuff on the persistent sore beside her mouth, but it stung horribly, and she washed it away in a hurry. "I want you to wipe this goddamn thing off," she said. Roland shook his head. "We'll give it a little longer to heal on its own."
"Why?"
"Cutting on a sore's a bad idea unless you absolutely have to do it, especially out here in what Jake would have called the boondogs." She agreed, without bothering to correct his pronunciation, but unpleasant images crept into her head when she lay down. Visions of the pimple beginning to spread, erasing her face inch by inch, turning her entire head into a black, crusted, bleeding tumor. In the dark, such visions had a horrible persuasiveness, but luckily she was too tired for them to keep her awake long. On their second day in what Susanna was coming to think of as the hide camp, Roland built a large and rickety frame over a new fire, one that was low and slow. They smoked the hides two by two and then laid them aside. The smell of the finished product was surprisingly pleasant. "It smells like leather," she thought, holding one to her face, and then had to laugh. That was, after all, exactly what it was. The third day they spent making, and here Susanna finally outdid the gunslinger. Roland sewed a wide and barely serviceable stitch. She thought that the vests and leggings he made would hold together for a month, two at the most, then begin to pull apart. She was far more adept. Sewing was a skill she'd learned from her mother and both grandmothers. At first she found Roland's bone needles maddeningly clumsy, and she paused long enough to cover both the thumb and forefinger of her right hand with little deerskin caps which she tied in place. After that it went faster. And by mid-afternoon of making day, she was taking garments from Roland's pile and over-sewing his stitches with her own, which were finer and closer. She thought he might object to this. Men were proud, but he didn't, which was probably wise. It quite likely would have been Detta who replied to any whines and queasies. By the time their third night in hide camp had come, they each had a vest, a pair of leggings, and a coat. They also had a pair of mittens each. These were large and laughable, but would keep their hands warm. And speaking of hands, Susanna was once more barely able to bend hers. She looked doubtfully at the remaining hides and asked Roland if they would spend another making day here. He considered the idea, then shook his head. "We'll load the ones that are left into the Hofat taxi, I think, along with some of the meat and chunks of ice from the stream to keep it cool and good.
The taxi won't be any good when we come to the snow, will it?"
"No," he admitted. "But by then the rest of the hides will be clothing and the meat will be eaten."
"You just can't stay here any longer, that's what it comes down to, isn't it? You hear it calling. The tower."
Roland looked into the snapping fire and said nothing. Nor had to.
"What'll we do about hauling our gunner when we come to the White Lands?"
"Make a travoy. And there'll be plenty of game." She nodded and started to lie down. He took her shoulders and turned her toward the fire instead. His face came close to hers, and for a moment, Susanna thought he meant to kiss her goodnight. He looked long and hard at the crusted sore beside her mouth instead.
"Well?"
she finally asked. She could have said more, but he would have heard the tremor in her voice. "I think it's a little smaller. Once we leave the Badlands behind, it may heal on its own.
Do you really say so?
The gunslinger shook his head at once. I say may. Now lie over, Susanna. Take your rest.
All right, but don't you let me sleep late this time. I want to watch my share.
Yes, now lie over.
She did as he said, and was asleep even before her eyes closed. 10. She's in Central Park, and it's cold enough to see her breath. The sky overhead is white from side to side, a snow sky, but she's not cold. No, not in her new deerskin coat, leggings, vest, and funny deerskin mittens. There's something on her head, too, pulled down over her ears and keeping them as toasty as the rest of her. She takes the cap off, curious, and sees it's not deerskin like the rest of her new clothing, but a red and green stocking cap. Written across the front is Merry Christmas. She looks at it, startled. Can you have deja vu in a dream? Apparently so. She looks around, and there are Eddie and Jake grinning at her. Their heads are bare, and she realizes she has in her hands a combination of the caps they were wearing in some other dream. She feels a great, soaring burst of joy, as if she has just solved some supposedly insoluble problem. Squaring the circle, let us say, or finding the ultimate prime number. Take that, Blaine, may it bust your brain, you crazy choo-choo train. Eddie is wearing a sweatshirt that says, I drink Nozzola. Jake is wearing one that says, I drive the Takuro Spirit. Both have cups of hot chocolate, the perfect kind, mit Schlag on top and little sprinkles of nutmeg dotting the cream. What world is this? She asks them, and realizes that somewhere nearby, carolers are singing, What child is this? You must let him go his course alone, says Eddie. Yar, and you must beware of Dandolo, says Jake. I don't understand, Susanna says, and holds out her stocking cap to them. Wasn't this yours? Didn't you share it? It could be your hat if you want it, says Eddie, and then holds out his cup. Here, I brought you hot chocolate. No more twins, says Jake. There's only one hat, do you not see? Before she can reply, a voice speaks out of the air and the dream begins to unravel. 19, says the voice. This is 19. This is Chasset. With each word, the world becomes more unreal. She can see through Eddie and Jake. The good smell of hot chocolate is fading, being replaced by the smell of ash, Wednesday, and leather. She sees Eddie's lips moving, and she thinks he's saying a name, and then... 11.
Time to get up, Susanna, Roland said. It's your watch.
She sat up, looking around. The campfire had burned low.
I heard him moving out there, Roland said, but that was some time ago. Susanna, are you all right? Were you dreaming?
Yes, she said. There was only one hat in this dream, and I was wearing it.
I don't understand you. Nor did she understand herself. The dream was already fading, as dreams do. All she knew for sure was that the name on Eddie's lips, just before he faded away for good, had been that of Patrick Danville.